You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. Coming up, the new documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, looks at how the U.S. responded and, in some cases, failed to respond to the Holocaust. One of the filmmakers joins the show. Now imagine a world where you can walk down the sidewalk in your neighborhood and find fresh fruits, veggies, nuts growing right out of the ground for anyone to pick and eat for free. It's a future that a Wisconsin nonprofit group is trying to make a reality. They're called Wisconsin Food Forests. They already have a few projects running in La Crosse, Madison, and Milwaukee. You can also do it in your own front or backyard. Emily Steinway is one of the co-founders of Wisconsin Food Forests. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you paint us a picture of how a food forest works?
Well, ironically, the easiest way to plant one is to start with a flat mowed lawn. So once you have that, you can add in the edible, mostly native, and mostly perennial plants of choice. So we usually go with fruit trees and shrubs. We'll plant things for pollinators as well, herbs, ground covers like strawberry, and we'll also put in some shrubs. Occasionally we'll do some perennial vegetables, and they all kind of grow together. You plant the taller plants to the north and the shorter plants to the south so that everything gets plenty of sunlight. And it's basically trying to mimic a forest ecosystem because it's such a stable way of producing food.
And the concept here is you're not just growing it for yourself to eat or sell or something like this. The idea is it's in a public-ish space where, what, people can stop by and snack for free?
Yes. Yeah, we try to plant these food forests for free on public land or for other nonprofit organizations. So the main one that has been the most successful is called Lansing Food Forest, and it's on the east side of Madison. And the neighborhood, the Eastmoreland neighborhood, has really embraced it and helped with maintenance and let us use their water, which was critical for getting the food forest established. And now people, yeah, they come by and they pick strawberries with their kids, or they'll harvest tomatoes in the summer. And it's also become a neighborhood gathering space. So we'd like to plant food forests so that they're accessible for people.
What was the inspiration for this idea for you?
Well, for me, I've always enjoyed eating fruit. And so I started out as a hobby planting fruit trees for friends and family, and then I turned it into a business. And then when my friend Aaron and Rodney came up with the idea for Wisconsin Food Forests and asked me to join, I was super excited and started scheming and planning right away. And we planted our first food forest with our organization in 2019 at a farm sanctuary, so that the plants will be there for not only the people, but also for the farm animals.
Now, as you mentioned, this could be on private land or land owned by a nonprofit. You've also worked with city governments. Are there likely suspects out there, patches of land that don't have a lot of other good options for them? What kind of things are you looking for?
Yeah, so we're lucky here in Madison. We have the city of Madison has the edible landscape permit process, which is a page on their website and a whole series of steps that you can follow in order to plant on city-owned land. And that's how we got Lansing Food Forest. It's on city engineering land. We've been contacted by people from other cities around Wisconsin to help them figure out how they can work with their city. And it usually involves meeting with your city representative, your alder, or someone on the city council, and reaching out to the people in your community, talking to them, seeing who's interested. It only takes about 3 or 4 people to get the whole process going, and we're definitely able to help with that. We're hoping to do something in Fort Atkinson next year, and also in Sharon, Wisconsin, and Reedsburg, Wisconsin. We've been working with them as well.
And I understand, at least from your website, you were looking for more possible food forest sites in 2023. If people are out there hearing this thinking, yeah, that sounds cool, and I know just the spot, what do you want to hear from them? What can they do to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so our website is wisconsinfoodforests.com, or they can email us at contact@wisconsinfoodforests.com. We do have a couple things in the works for 2023, but nothing is set in stone yet. So we're still looking for a few more potential sites.
And it sounds like step one is clearly building your local team. Do you have suggestions on how to reach out to, I guess, neighbors in particular to say, hey, does this sound cool to you?
Yeah. Find a site if you can, something that's flat and mowed, because that's going to be the easiest to transform. And then find a water source is also critical. So either city water or a neighbor who's willing to let people use their water. And you only need to water for the first 1 or 2 or 3 years, because since we're mostly planting perennials, once they get established, your watering needs go way down. And they're also going to be generating their own mulch once the forest is more mature. So if you have those things and then just a few people, you can get a food forest going in your community.
Emily, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Emily Steinway, one of the co-founders of Wisconsin Food Forests. She was with us today for a look at their efforts to grow free fruit and vegetable and nut plants on public lands for anyone to eat. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in La Crosse. He's one of the people featured in a new podcast, WPR Reports, Uprooted.
When Ernesto Rodriguez of La Crosse was 24 years old, he left the only home he'd ever known, Cuba.
And then when they asked me, do you want to leave Cuba? I go, yeah, because I don't want to be there.
He, along with 125,000 of his fellow Cubans, hopped on boats bound for the United States in 1980. They were part of the mass exodus known as the Mariel Boatlift, a rare moment when President Fidel Castro allowed residents to leave the island. Among that group that fled, almost 15,000 ended up at Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, including Erne. And while living there, Erne spent a lot of time in the kitchen. The staff were cooking the refugees American food, like hamburgers and hot dogs, food they hadn't developed a taste for yet. So a cook named Tony asked Erne a question.
And Tony asked me, what kind of food you guys like? It's Cuban food. I said, what the Cuban food? And then I show him like how to make a congee and a chicken fricassee and mashed potato, but not like mashed potato from here is different.
And it's in this kitchen that Erne met someone who was born and raised in Sparta, someone who had become family.
I'm just Brian Brandstetter. Erne's my brother from another mother.
Mm-hmm.
My family was one of the sponsors of Erne back in 1980.
We are a good friend, we are a good brother, because I love the guy like he's my own brother.
Well, I've been your brother longer than not. Yeah, 41 years, 1980, wow.
In order for Erne to get out of Fort McCoy, he had to find a sponsor who would vouch for him and help him find housing and a job. That's where the Brandstetters come in. Brian's parents, Roger and Annette Brandstetter, became Erne's sponsors. Erne went to live with the family in Sparta.
Yeah, they moved into my bedroom and they wore our clothes that they could fit in. My parents would go shopping for them. You know, they fed them. They gave them love.
Yeah, Mom. She was the best mom. I never had a mom.
Erne's new mom, Annette, is one of the most important people in his life.
I told her, my mom, every birthday, she making me an upside-down pineapple cake. Every birthday.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say, Mom, I don't want this no more. You. And she called me, Erne, happy birthday. Come and get your cake. They said, wow, man, I'm lucky. Because they give me everything. I don't need nothing. They give me everything.
Roger got Erne a job at his car dealership. And this was a big deal, since it was not always easy for Cubans to find jobs.
And my dad had a very optimistic view. He goes, oh, we'll teach them English. We'll get them into church. We'll get them working.
But Brian says once they got to church, the new community wasn't necessarily welcoming of his new brother.
My parents lost a lot of their right-leaning friends because they're like, how could you do this? You let them into your house. You let them work for you. And it's crazy. They didn't feel good about it. Our mom was a very stern woman, and she wasn't going to take any crap from anybody. So she'd get all uppity, and she wouldn't care, and she'd create enemies.
Despite the pushback, Brian and Erne remained tight. They're family now.
Because nobody does that for a black guy in another country. And I always call you are my real mom.
Erne's journey to the United States wasn't easy. He's been through a lot, but he found sponsors who loved him and cared for him. Sponsors who would help him start a new life in Wisconsin. To learn more about Erne's life in Cuba, how he served in the military, was sent to prison, and took a treacherous boat ride to get to the United States, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos can be found at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talked to one of the directors and producers of the new PBS documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, which looks at how the U.S. responded and failed to respond to the Nazis' genocidal attacks on European Jews. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new documentary that Ken Burns says is the most important he's ever worked on examines the U.S. response to the Holocaust. The film, in 3 parts, looks at how racist immigration laws passed in the 1920s kept many Jewish refugees from escaping, how the country was far from a united front when it came to helping European Jews, and the tragic repercussions of public indifference and inaction. In an op-ed for the LA Times, the filmmakers wrote, quote, "Do Americans today have the courage to look at the mistakes of our past for the sake of our improvement?" Sarah Botstein is an award-winning documentary film producer. She's a co-director and co-producer of the PBS documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, along with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. It'll re-air on PBS Wisconsin in January, and it's available online. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was a long time in the making. What was the inspiration to tackle the U.S. and its relationship to the Holocaust?
Well, Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, Jeff Ward, the incredible writer, and I all have different reasons for being extremely interested in this subject and films that we've made in the past, whether it was a series we did on the Second World War or a series that Jeff and Ken did on the Roosevelt Project. We've sort of, you know, been circling around aspects of what we explore in this film for many years. But in 2015, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. approached us as they were beginning research on a major exhibition that they launched subsequently in 2018 entitled Americans and the Holocaust. And they asked if we thought it was an interesting subject for a documentary and would we be interested. And we all said, absolutely, it's an extraordinarily important subject to try to understand this period in American history through a slightly different lens. And we said yes to making the film in 2015 and really got started a few years later.
And we usually learn about the Holocaust from the European perspective, Hitler's rise to power, the experience of Jews and other groups targeted by Nazis. What did we learn? What did you learn as you started shifting that perspective to what was going on here in the United States?
Well, thank you for that question. You know, I think we teach in America some of the themes that we explore in the film and some of the aspects that I think are the farther away we get from it, more important about the Second World War generally, kind of in separate silos and lanes. And so if you're exploring the subject of the U.S. response to the Holocaust, you need to do 2 things. One, you need to actually understand the chronology of the Holocaust. And that is a European story in some way, right? But you also have to understand what Americans knew, when we knew the information, and how we responded to it. So you can shift away from the crisis in Europe to, I think what we're experiencing now in our current politics of how do we respond as a citizenry and as a government to crises around the world.
A key part of the timeline was a new series of immigration policies in the United States in the 1920s that were then in place, of course, in the 1930s. 1933, Hitler comes to power. Can you talk about those immigration policies and then how they affected Jewish refugees trying to make it here to the United States?
Yes, absolutely. Centrally important part of the story and, you know, a primary focus of the first of the three episodes that we put together. You know, until the 1920s, America was largely a country of open borders. It was very easy to get here. We did not have official immigration restrictive policies. We had the Chinese Exclusion Act, obviously, but things really began to change in the early part of the 20th century. And in 1921, and then in 1924, we had our first complicated and deeply restrictive immigration laws and quotas, and then actually didn't have an official refugee policy on top of that. So the time when, looking back at this history, we could have done the most in an interesting way is actually before 1939, as Hitler, as you just said, came to power, and then the crisis of the Jews in Europe, rose and rose and rose. Americans could have bended policy much more easily than once we were actually involved in the war.
And through the 30s, then there was you detail in the series a debate, a lively debate. Some people passionately arguing that we needed to loosen up those laws to let more Jewish refugees in. Others, I guess, keeping the status quo of what those rules were at the time. Can you talk about that period of debate?
Right. So I think it's important to understand. To understand the debate, to understand actually the deep and complicated history of American anti-Semitism, actually, and how prevalent and mainstream anti-Semitism was even in our own State Department and government. So, you know, those debates, I think, mirror the sentiments of the country. And one of the things I think is lost the farther away we get is how, you know, what the history of American anti-Semitism is and how it relates to a kind of racist, nativist, isolationist sentiment here.
Can you talk? I mean, it comes out as incredibly blatant, I think, by our standards today. What kind of things were people, even at the highest levels of government, saying faced with this reality of Jewish refugees seeking to come into the country?
Well, obviously, there's lots of offensive and racist and anti-Semitic language and cartoons and expressions. But, you know, I think the polling is also an important piece of to answer your question, that Americans were polled consistently during this time about what to do. And while Americans might have expressed sorrow and horror at some of the things they were hearing, that did not move the needle in terms of public debate or a change in attitudes toward Jewish people coming here and other refugees seeking asylum.
Can you talk about the human impact this ended up having, the anti-Semitic driven immigration policies? What was the human cost?
So, you know, we let in over 200,000 refugees, more than any other sovereign nation took in during this time, and 2/3 of the Jews of Europe were wiped out. So I think that's a question deeply complicated to answer. But, you know, I think the world failed the Jews in Europe. We failed the Jews of Europe. This is a great humanitarian crisis in human history, and we still have things to learn from it.
And I wanted to get into that in our last couple of minutes. There are debates about how we teach all parts of American history, I think, in our schools today. How much do we celebrate American history? How much do we look into the mistakes, the crimes, the bad things that have happened? Can you talk about the value of looking back, taking a tough look at moments like this in our history and trying to learn from them today?
Thank you for that question. I think that's the central thing that we're facing as a country. For me personally, I think you can celebrate the great privilege that it is to live in a mostly working democracy and how sacred our right to vote is, how important it is to have a government that reflects and is, a Democrat, principally democratic. Having said that, I think the film shows how quickly civilized institutions and democracies can fail. And so teaching American history is central to that question. I don't think it makes sense to teach. You have to understand a deeply complicated past and celebrate what is good about our country, as well as we say in the film, some of the dark marks, so that you can do better in the future. Those things are not in conflict to me. Those things are actually in concert with one another.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sarah Botstein, award-winning documentary film producer. She talked to us about her new documentary. She's a co-producer and co-director, The U.S. and the Holocaust. You can go to the PBS Wisconsin website to find out how to view that, either through the website or an encore presentation of it coming up, I believe, in January. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are some signs that the opioid epidemic may be slowing down, especially among younger people. A guest makes the case that we need to learn lessons now to help prevent the next widespread addiction problem before it starts. And get ready for Halloween with a look at some great horror movies. A Wisconsin film expert is going to join the show to share recommendations. I understand she's a big fan, and we're hoping you'll tell us some of your favorites or the ones that were maybe too scary for you. Let us know right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Do you have a go-to Halloween movie ritual that you watch every year around this time? Let us know your favorites. Again, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Halloween movies and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then once upon a time, late night TV talk shows were the talk of the workplace the next morning. They're still there, but things have changed a lot. We'll look at the past, present, and future of late night talk. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, surveys show that inflation and the broader economy are on many voters' minds as we move toward the midterm election. How about you? We'll talk about the politics of inflation and the economy as election issues. First, the late-night television talk show landscape is set to change in the coming months, and the changes come as the future of the late-night format is in question. Earlier this year, James Corden announced he'll be leaving The Late Late Show next spring. More recently, Trevor Noah said he's stepping away from The Daily Show in December. Last year, Conan O'Brien ended his 28-year run as a late-night host, and TBS got out of the talk show wars entirely with the cancellation of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee this summer. The changes come as traditional late-night talk show television ratings have been declining since the heydays of Jay Leno and David Letterman in the 1990s. As more and more viewers and video content switch to online streaming, it leaves an unclear future for late-night talk shows that once dominated American popular culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch late-night talk shows yourself in real time, or do you watch funny bits when they pop up on some form of social media or YouTube the next day? Were these kind of shows once part of your regular viewing at night, whether we're going back to Carson or Leno or Letterman or pick your era? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Koblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the TV industry. He's co-author of the book, It's Not TV, The Spectacular Rise, Revolution, and Future of HBO. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me on.
Before we get into some of the specific changes lately, can you talk about the big picture trends that led from, the only game in town pretty much was talk shows at late night for a long time, and now not so much?
Yeah, you did a great job summing up all these departures that are coming up. And this has happened in late night before. In 2014 and 2015, We saw Jay Leno, Dave Letterman, and Jon Stewart all depart at relatively, in a sort of truncated period of time. And at that point, 7 or 8 years ago, the entire television industry and news media was interested in on the short list. Who's going to replace these hosts? There's something different about these departures this time. When James Corden announced he was leaving, the president of CBS said, we're not going to stick with the same old host behind a desk format. We're going to think about something else. And Trevor Noah's replacement for The Daily Show, that might be a multi-host reformatted show as well. When you talk to producers in the late night field, they say that there's something different this time. And the something different, diminished ratings, less revenue. NBC has considered spinning off Seth Meyers' 12:30 show on NBC. They've considered spinning that off to MSNBC. So it's a pretty challenged genre. And I think it is fair to ask the question at this point, what is the future of the late night show?
Yeah, the content of late night shows doesn't necessarily fit well with streaming, right? The Game of Thrones, say you watch that when it first breaks or 2 days later or 2 years later, still the same show. That topical monologue at the beginning of a late night show doesn't make sense 2 days or 2 weeks later.
Yeah, this is probably the biggest challenge. As we've seen with both scripted entertainment and even unscripted entertainment, it has made the transition from network television, cable television, to streaming very, very nicely. Late night shows depend on topicality. They depend on what people are talking about that day, or at least within the last few days. And that is not how people experience streaming entertainment. Netflix was really, they really made a hard effort to make a talk show work 5, 6 years ago. They gave a talk show to Chelsea Handler. They gave one to Joel McHale. They gave one to Hasan Minhaj. None of them worked, and all of them were canceled. Hulu, similarly, they gave a show to Sarah Silverman. That was canceled after only a handful of episodes. Apple TV Plus, they just gave a show to Jon Stewart. The second season recently began, but the first season really had a tough time garnering significant attention. So late night, as we know it, going back to the Johnny Carson days, and then evolved by David Letterman, and then spun forward by Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert, that show where you have a host who does a monologue, sits behind the desk, does a funny sketch, does a celebrity interview, that just does not work on streaming.
Before he announced he was leaving The Daily Show, Trevor Noah was asked by an audience member what he thought the future of late night comedy would look like. Here's what he said.
Content is evergreen, right? There will always be content. I think when we consume content, will change. Like, some people go, this is a late night show. Some people don't think of it as a late night. They just go, it's a show. Then some people don't even think of it as a TV show. They go like, I love your show on YouTube. I love your show on TikTok. I love you on Snapchat. I love you on Facebook. I love, like, there's some people who go, if I go like, I have a TV show, they're like, what TV? Where? And they have no clue at all. My brother taught me this, my younger brother. He doesn't watch TV at all, but he's seen everything that's on TV.
Do you see that changing the content, John, where, okay, as opposed to doing something that's going to work in my live broadcast, I'm going to do something that's going to work for people to click on YouTube or Instagram or whatever?
Yeah, I think we saw that change when Jimmy Fallon took the reins of The Tonight Show in 2014. He really was creating content for it to go viral on YouTube. James Corden as well. That's where Carpool Karaoke began and became a huge hit. It became a huge hit on YouTube and not necessarily on CBS. The difference between now and then is the ratings have fallen even farther from where they were 8 years ago. And most significantly, the revenue has diminished. Most producers I talk to believe the genre will continue in some way in 5 or 10 years. It's just going to look radically different than it does today, mostly because we have to figure out, how does this work on the internet? How does this work digitally?
We're talking with New York Times media reporter John Coblin about changes in late night talk shows and where they could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think the late night talk show plays in American culture, or played, past tense, in American culture? Is there one you still watch live, or do you catch up the next day on? Fill in the blank there. Did you used to consistently watch one of the late night talk show hosts? Who was your favorite from the days of yore, whether that was 3 years ago or 30 years ago? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with here's John Coblin, media reporter for The New York Times, who covers the television industry. With us today, looking at changes coming to late night TV talk shows and the challenges those programs face in the streaming age. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the future holds for late night talk shows? What question you have about the changes that have been happening that may be coming in the future? Do you care who replaces James Corden on The Late Late Show, Trevor Noah on The Daily Show, or if those shows go away altogether? Was there a show in the past that, yeah, you really watched that all the time? What changed for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Mike is with us in Waukesha. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mike?
So it was interesting. I'm just driving on my way here in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I got to go pay a bill. But we were talking about why the late night people like Trevor Noah and why these shows are, let's say, being off the air, canceled, what have you. I have a suspicion that it's content as it relates to what people are calling the woke agenda and the woke mentality, in which late night used to be entertaining. It used to be funny. It even provided a little bit of variety. If you ask me, you know, the days of Carson, even Letterman, Leno. But what you didn't see the political push, it seems. And there's a saying out there. It says, get woke, go broke. While other people on YouTube and on Internet are doing quite well, the Rogans, the Tim Pools, Jordan Peterson, Russell Brand, they're growing. They're huge. So I don't necessarily think it's technology somewhat. I just think it's content, really.
Mike, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. We had another caller who was also worried about politics on these shows, liberal politics, they said, sneaking in. What do you think, John?
I mean, it cannot be discounted. Obviously, it's a factor. You know, ever since, much the way America has gone, late night television is gone. Once things started getting more divisive, and particularly when Donald Trump entered the fray in 2015 and then won the election in 2016, we've seen many of the late night hosts take on a more political bent to their shows, particularly Stephen Colbert, who's the most watched host in late night. His show has become a very political show that it cannot be discounted. It absolutely has to be considered a factor if you are turning off potentially half the audience. However, we also cannot discount the really the technological, the seismic technological shift. I mean, Rob, I was smiling when you came back from break and you're playing the Tonight Show theme. You know, that when the Tonight Show was on, when Johnny Carson was hosting it, when Jay Leno hosted it, you had America watching NBC from 8 to 11 p.m., watching their local news at 11, and then they just transitioned right into Johnny at 11:30. You had millions of people doing that every night. Those habits are broken permanently. You do not have even close to the same number of viewers watching NBC or CBS or ABC between 8 and 11 p.m. And if you have fewer people to begin with, you have fewer people sticking around for 11:30 and 12:30.
Is there, do you see any way to bring back that kind of common language again, where people are saying, hey, did you see who was on Carson last night or something like that? Or is that something we just can't go back to, given all the variety out there?
I think it's extremely possible. And many of the late night producers and former producers who I spoke to are optimistic that something could work. One producer posited an interesting solution to me. Now Thursday Night Football is on the Amazon streaming service. You have 10, 11, 12 million people who are watching it on Amazon every week. When that ends, is there some sort of show that Amazon could put on, a topical live show afterwards, where people stick around for another hour? Is it going to look like the traditional late night show? No, but could you bring elements of the genre into something like that for sort of this big event programming, especially as it slowly makes its transition to streaming? That is a compelling theory, and it could work.
Now, with the couple changes we mentioned, Trevor Noah and James Corden, each on their shows for about 7 years before announcing their departures, here's a Corden talking to the entertainment news program Extra about the length of his stay on the show.
By the time we finish, I'll have done pretty much like 1,400 episodes. That's a lot. And I know that in America, these jobs are positions that people take for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. It was never, ever going to be that. For me.
Yeah, who'd want to host the same talk show for more than 7 years? I don't know about that. But this idea, I mean, it used to be like, you know, you're the Pope almost. This is a lifetime appointment once you landed that late night gig. And now it seems like, I don't know, a lot of the hosts have other things they could do out there.
Yeah, that's another big part of this. As we've learned with both the Corden and Trevor Noah departures, they don't see it as a lifetime appointment and they don't want a lifetime appointment. Trevor Noah, when he broke the news to viewers that he was leaving The Daily Show, he had told very few people that he was doing that. Much of his staff didn't know, and more significantly, his bosses didn't know. He completely blindsided them, and I think it was because he just wanted to get it out of the way, announce his departure on his terms so he could leave within a couple months, and he will be gone by December. Yeah, I mean, it's a grind. These are very hard jobs, and these hosts have a lot more options now. Take Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien had been in late night for nearly three decades. His show on TBS, they reformatted it within the last 2 years of its life, reducing it to a half hour and focusing on one guest for an interview. It didn't work. The ratings were really, really, really low for that show. But guess what happened? Conan O'Brien had a side project going. He had a podcast, a long-form interview program, interviewing other celebrities or journalists or interesting people. That is a huge hit. It's a huge hit. And Conan O'Brien just sold his podcast network to SiriusXM. So it really was a matter of genre, where Conan O'Brien was doing it. Late night wasn't working, but podcast does.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in San Jose, Costa Rica. Paul, hi.
Hello, hello. Greetings.
What did you want to bring up, Paul?
Frequent listener. From abroad. I've lived abroad for decades. I always watch the shows you're talking about. I watch them online. Thank God that they're streamed so I can see them because I wouldn't have access to them otherwise. So I think a lot of us watch those shows, whether it's the entire show of Colbert or Trevor Noah, or we're just clicking on the interviews and pieces that we want to see, and I would be really upset to lose them, much less I don't agree that it's about woke content at all. I think they're always topical and they keep me abreast of what's going on, and I enjoy the humor and it's part of my day to always check in with them.
And Paul, I got to ask, you mentioned sometimes you just click on interviews. Do you ever watch, you know, in real time live when those shows are broadcast?
I never do. I don't know that I ever have.
Gotcha. Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that. Interesting perspective there, John, on how he uses that.
Completely. I, you know what? He is like a lot of people out there. There are thousands and millions of people who are going to go ahead and click on a YouTube of what was Colbert's monologue last night. Oh, I heard Jimmy Fallon had Olivia Wilde on his show last night. I will watch that. And this worked for a while because there were enough viewers coming into the broadcast network where the network executives were happy. They were making plenty of money. And sure, let it be a hit on YouTube. The problem is simply the economics. You're making pennies on the dollar with those YouTube clicks. They just, if the viewers are not tuning in at high numbers into the network, the YouTube stuff just doesn't make economic sense. And these media companies have done a better job at moving a lot of this content to their own proprietary streaming services. But again, you know, how many subscribers are you going to get because you want to watch Stephen Colbert, you watch Jimmy Fallon? It may not be enough to justify the expenses of these shows. And these shows cost a lot of money. They could cost anywhere on a yearly basis between $60 and $100 million to produce.
Let's bring on another caller now. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hi.
What did you want to bring up, Richard?
I want to bring up the fact that, I'm talking to some other people right now.
Oh, okay. I'll let you go then, Richard. Let's go to Charles in Merrill. Charles, hi.
Hi there. I was wondering what your guest thought of John Oliver's show. I don't know if he'd consider it a late night show or not, but he has, you know, kind of exactly what the last caller was talking about, lots of topical, societal and political, you know, topics on videos on YouTube that are fantastic. I think he's on HBO, and we've considered getting HBO because we love his show so much.
Interesting, Charles. You've written a bit, I think, John, about HBO. Thoughts on John Oliver and if he would actually be, you know, getting people to subscribe?
It's such a great question, Charles. I would say John Oliver is kind of the exception to the rule here, but he does something different, right? He's a weekly show, and he's not on 52 weeks a year. It's less than that, but it's a weekly show. It's a 30-minute show, and he usually does a little, you know, song and dance. He does, like, you know, does some comedy bits at the top, but it's usually a single topic. And it's kind of a journalistic show, too. But for the purposes of the genre, I do think it counts as a late-night show. In fact, it has won the Best Variety Talk Show Emmy Award, I believe, 7 years in a row, beating Colbert, beating Kimmel, beating Seth Meyers, year in and year out. I think one of the things that benefited John Oliver is his show started before the streaming era really began to dominate entertainment. It started as an HBO proper show. So I think he has successfully made the transition to the other side, where plenty of people are watching him on HBO Max, even if not as many people are watching him on HBO, the cable network. But John Oliver is an example of a success story here.
And speaking of shows that, like, do they fit the genre? People have pointed toward Greg Gutfeld on Fox News. So it's a more conservative leaning sort of talk show on a network where people, you know, the built-in audience would match up well with that. Where does that fit into this discussion?
It's a late night political and comedy show, and it is definitely worked. I mean, you know, Fox has, it's an 11 p.m. show. Fox has done a number of experiments at 11 p.m., and this is the one that's taken hold. Many network executives sort of bristle at the comparison that Gutfeld is the same genre as what they're doing. And notably, they will point out that he is live at 8 p.m. on the West Coast, so he gets the Goose's numbers even more. And also, Fox viewers are very loyal to their network. They will stay from afternoon until night. So there is a smooth transition from Tucker to Laura Ingraham to Hannity to Gutfeld.
Now, bringing things around, you recently co-wrote a piece headlined, "Is There a Future for Late Night Talk Shows?" What are you watching for in the future? Is there going to be a late night talk show, or are we going to translate this all into, I don't know, YouTube and podcast video series? What are you watching for in the future?
In the short term, let's see who replaces Trevor Noah. Let's see who replaces James Corden. I suspect both Comedy Central and CBS are going to try to shake up the format. Not many networks have tried to shake up the format. So let's see if those efforts are successful. I have a careful eye on Stephen Colbert's contract is up next year. Does he re-sign? If he re-signs, is it a short 1 or 2 year deal, or is it a 3-4 year deal? The Tonight Show, NBC is considering giving up its 10 p.m. primetime hour and giving it to local affiliates. Does the Tonight Show move up to 10:30 or 11 p.m. if so? And does that work? Do more viewers come in to watch it? And similarly, what happens to Seth Meyers at 12:30? It's a popular show. It's a niche show, but it always gets critical recognition. Does that continue to run at 12:30, or do NBC executives decide to put it on their streaming service or on their cable news network?
And finally, John, you know, if I'm watching TV after 10 o'clock, it's either I'm still watching a live sporting event, or I'm pulling up something to stream, probably, you know, a TV show of some sort, fictionalized TV show. Are people like me killing this late night talk show format?
Luckily, you're not alone, so we don't have to single you out, Rob. Yes. We are collectively really getting it closer to life support because we're just not watching the way we did 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
John, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
John Coblin is a media reporter for the New York Times covering the television industry. He was with us today looking at the present and future of late night television talk shows in the streaming age. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your all-time favorite. If you had one you watched reliably every night, if you could, let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, how does the economy look from where you're sitting? If it's influencing how you're voting in the midterm election, how is it influencing your vote? We'll talk about inflation and other economic issues in the midterms. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.